against homeless people in Vancouver. There's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Today is Friday, the 12th of September. I'm Morme Zanke.
And I'm Alexander Sarah Davis. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the UBC of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:07 p.m. and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories are segments, our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science findings.
We also have an interview with Ashley Bentley, the acting manager of the AMS Sexual Assault Support Clinic.
Later in the program, a live interview with Nadia Roberts, one of the volunteer organizers of the upcoming Rally for Arbitration, being held this Sunday at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, it's homecoming weekend at UBC. A pep rally and barbecue will begin at 12 p.m. this weekend and at 2, or today. No, wait. What is it? Okay. Well, anyway. At 2, the UBC Thunderbirds will kick off against Calgary in a game that is sure to excite. And paint your face and get your UBC pride on for homecoming 2014.
Arvind Gupta has been formally sworn in as the President and Vice Chancellor of UBC. In an open email to faculty and students, Gupta thanked the community for their support. It reads, quote, "Now is a time for optimism, for excitement at what is to come, and again for thanks. I know that so many of you will be integral to the success UBC will enjoy in the coming years," end quote. Gupta was publicly named President back in March.
In local news, BC Ferries ridership declines by 11%, loses $2 billion in economic activity because of increased fares. A report released on Wednesday, September 10th, announced the major decline in sales since 2003. This was the first report ever to be released about the Crown Corporation. According to the report, if the government had adjusted the prices based on the rate of inflation over the course of the decade, ridership would have increased by 19%. Since they did not, $2.3 billion was lost to the province, as well as $609 million that could have been generated for tax revenue and for federal, provincial, and municipal governments. The report also states that although BC Ferries is a sustainable system, while their ridership declined, most other forms of transit in BC saw a surge of usership in the last decade. The release of this report provides an opportunity to rethink the policies that direct the funding of BC Ferries, said UBCM President Rona Martin. The report is set to be discussed in 2 weeks' time at the annual UBCM convention in Whistler.
More former foster children are attending university thanks to tuition waivers. 38 students will be attending Vancouver Island University tuition-free this year, more than double the 16 students who accessed the program last year. Students at VIU also received an additional $500 for books and other school-related items. VIU was the first university in the province to act on children's advocate Mary Ellen Turple-Lanford's call to waive tuition fees for youth who had been in the foster system. Six other post-secondary institutions also offer bursaries or free tuition, including Langara College, the University of Victoria, BCIT, and UBC.
In national news, two Canadian brothers have been confirmed to have joined ISIS in Iraq and Syria. Ibrahim Kanadi, real name Colin Gordon, and his brother Greg left for Syria in late 2012. Both of them are converts to Islam who grew up and were educated in Calgary. Colin was a graduate of the Southern Alberta Institute of Technology. Around the time he attended SAIT, Colin lived in the same Calgary building that housed other now notorious Canadian jihadis, Damien Claremont, Farah Sheridan, and Salman Ashrafi, all dead as a result of their missions. The whereabouts of the Gordon brothers is not known, but they are assumed alive.
Collins' Twitter feed was the last active August 24th in a tweet he wrote, quote, hashtag losing Iraq. U.S. war strategists and commanders don't understand this war and why they receive the orders they receive. Hashtag IS, hashtag caliphate, hashtag Iraq, hashtag sham. Only days earlier, he commented on the murder of James Foley, dubbing it the perfection of terrorism. Stories of Westerners joining the ranks of ISIS are not uncommon. Just last week, the U.S. National Security Council confirmed the death of Douglas McCain, the first known American to be killed as an Islamic militant. Much like the militant ring formed in Calgary, McCain is reportedly one of several jihadi fighters to come out of Robbinsdale Cooper High School near Minneapolis. On some level, ISIS seems to have been successful in its ability to recruit young Western militants. Now seems like the time to build some sort of conversation about what we can do to prevent future recruits from making the long trip to a baseless holy war.
Rob Ford has withdrawn from the Toronto mayoral race. As of this Friday, September 12th, Rob Ford has announced his withdrawal from his re-election bid. His brother, Councillor Doug Ford, will be replacing him in the race. The reason for his withdrawal are speculative at this moment. However, it was reported on Wednesday that Rob Ford was sent to the hospital with stomach pain, where doctors discovered a fair-sized mass in his stomach. Even if the mass turns out to be benign, the surgical process would take him out of the campaign. It's been reported that Rob will run for his old council seat, replacing his nephew, Michael Ford. There are only 6 weeks to Election Day, and this shift in candidates comes as a surprise to many voters. In a statement released earlier today, Rob Ford said, quote, "My heart is heavy when I tell you that I'm unable to continue my campaign for re-election as your mayor. While I'm unable to commit to the heavy schedule required for a mayoral candidate, I will not turn my back on Ward 2. I will be running as councillor of 2 to represent the fine folks that have become my neighbors and friends over these past 14 years. I have asked Doug to run to become the next mayor of Toronto because we need him. We cannot go backwards," end quote.
And in international news, the Ebola virus continues to spread with more than 2,200 deaths and counting. The virus first originated in southern Guinea, but has since spread to Liberia, Nigeria, Senegal, and Sierra Leone. What is odd about this particular strain of EVD is the quick way in which it spreads. Usually when EVD passes from animal to human, only a few dozen people get sick. But in this case, hundreds of people were infected from the beginning, and now the rate of growth is exponential. Another factor contributing to the fast spread is the area of origin. There are areas in West Africa that are very poor, and they do not have the resources and people to contain the disease. EVD has a long incubation period of about a week, which is helpful in containing the disease, but without proper aid, this is impossible. Locals in the area also have a deeply seated mistrust in authority, which increases the difficulty of managing the population and control of EVD. In the last 38 years, there have been 20 outbreaks of EVD around the world, and all of them were contained successfully. However, this strain is the largest in magnitude and will take a committed response to overcome. West Africa looks for international support as they struggle to combat the virus. This assistance is starting to surface from the international community as of Wednesday. The U.S. donated 5 ambulances to Sierra Leone to help pick up dead bodies to decrease contamination. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation donated $50 million with a goal of finding a vaccine and therapy for the virus. The UN also set aside $3.8 million to back an emergency air service in Ebola-hindered areas.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Nisiam, Nisiaya, Thikum Queen Ansep, Hydra CM, Nisiam, Nisiaya,
and the Skahuya, Talitin, Homasqueam, Mustail. Considering studying abroad? Visit the Study and Go Abroad Fair on Saturday, September 27th at the Vancouver Convention Center East Wing to meet top universities from around the world offering postgrad, undergrad, and diploma programs abroad. Visit the Travel Zone for volunteering, language programs, adventure travel, and work abroad. Expo opens at 1 p.m., but come early at noon for our feature seminar on scholarships. Admission is free. Check the website for more info at studyandgoabroad.com.
Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. Traditional journalistic outlets are often viewed as monoliths. Newspapers such as the New York Times and the Globe and Mail are cited as papers of record, as if they stood for some absolute journalistic truth. However, it's no secret that traditional journalism is facing hard times at the moment. Just earlier this year, the CBC announced a strategy that would cut nearly 25% of its staff in the next 5 years. In May, Torstar Corp., owners of the Toronto Star, were forced to sell their book publishing segment, Harlequin, to compensate for declining advertising revenues. For now, it seems that the monoliths are crumbling. This transition has given way to smaller, independent outlets that are finding their voices in the wake of the destruction. A new collective at UBC is attempting to do just that. The Talon is a student publication set to launch later this month. Their mandate is to, quote, fill the void of critical, independent student media within UBC. They intend to focus on issues of social justice and accessibility affecting UBC students. Live in studio, I have Aruba Jamal and Jordan Buffy to tell me more about this exciting adventure. Hello, guys.
Hey, Costa. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. So at first, I just want to ask, where did the idea for the Talon come from?
That's a really good question and a big one, too. It was definitely at the onset of this end of last semester, through online social forums, and just kind of a group of us were just talking through these forums about the kind of events that had happened during the school year last year, and some of the coverage for those events, and just thinking about how we really just wanted more critical perspectives on those issues. And so a group of us came together and we were just like, you know what? We don't see an outlet for some of the things that we want to talk about. We don't see an outlet for some of the diverse topics we want to cover. So let's start our own publication.
Yeah, the whole affair was actually really quite informal. I would say at the beginning there were maybe five or six of us who got together. And we all sort of shared the sentiment that there wasn't enough alternative media on campus at UBC. And there certainly wasn't any kind of activist outlet on campus. And now I say we're at 18 core members now.
Yeah.
So it's inflated quite quickly. Mm-hmm. But it was really quite laid back and casual. We got together and we said, well, what if we agreed to write something through a critical lens every so often.
On that note, earlier this month, you guys posed a question on Facebook, which I would like to perhaps direct back at you. And you've already alluded to an answer. And perhaps if you could again speak individually to this, why is an alternative student press at UBC important to you?
Well, personally, I think in the grand scheme of things, where I get my news from, the perspectives that I like to follow typically don't come from mainstream journalism. And I do end up, sifting through sources to find information that speaks to me, that is relevant to me, and that speaks truth to power, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So I think our idea with our publication is to be intentional about centering the voices of the marginalized, centering issues that are relevant to students, but also connect to like larger Vancouver issues and even international issues. So I think, definitely just having those diverse and alternative perspectives is very important.
Right. My reasons are largely the same. To be very simple, I think that more diverse student journalism is a good thing and that a lack of it is sort of bad. And I think that we've been wanting more diverse journalism for a long time. And just to go off what Aruba was saying, a more perhaps an outlet that didn't necessarily adhere to the idea of journalistic objectivity, because sometimes journalistic objectivity doesn't get it right and sometimes it's entirely lacking in objectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt if there's an opportunity to join an outlet that is going to offer a very particular perspective on an issue, that it's just as well, mm-hmm. because there's a complete lack of any alternative perspectives altogether.
You touch a lot on issues of diversity and inclusion. And on that subject, I was wondering, as a collective, how diverse are you in your makeup and in your editorial and volunteer base? And how diverse do you intend to be and how do you intend to encourage that diversity?
Our collective member is, we all have different backgrounds, we all have different experiences, but we all have this commitment to social justice, we all have a commitment to anti-oppression, and our team members are made up of folks from all sorts of disciplines. There's quite a few racialized members on our team, and that was very important to us as well.
Where did you all find each other? That's exciting.
That's a good question. But I think it was mostly through like a lot of like UBC needs groups, right? Like there's a UBC needs feminism, UBC needs mm-hmm. decolonization, and the UBC activist network. And then I guess a lot of us kind of very organically and informally thought about folks that we knew that we would want to be a part of this initiative because we know of their interests and their like background in doing social justice organizing and also their background in like even writing and things like that as well. So that kind of like combination. Yeah.
If I could weigh on it, I guess I would say we didn't actually all know each other. It was maybe four or five of us who knew one another personally, who got together and had the original impetus for the idea. And then we reached out to people that we knew were associated with various organizations. And we tried to be as diverse as we could in looking for those people. One of my favorite things about the makeup of the Talon is its diverse academic background and its diverse activist background. People from computer science, people from First Nation studies, people from English, people from international relations, and so on and so forth. So,
And people with backgrounds in feminist organizing, but also decolonization organizing or animal activist organizing. So, like, even our academic background is diverse, but also our experiences in social justice as well.
Is your collective limited to UBC students?
Yeah. Our impetus is definitely to have a UBC-focused publication, and so all of us are UBC students, but like I said earlier, we will touch upon obviously local issues and international issues, but also find it a way to bring it back to UBC, and currently all of our editorial members are from UBC.
In your mandate, you acknowledge that there is no such thing as true journalistic objectivity, which is something I think Jordan mentioned earlier, and that as you've also mentioned, different members of your collective have different interests and experiences. As a collective, editorially, how do you intend to maneuver these differences?
I'm sorry, could you repeat the latter half of the question?
So as a collective, when with different interests and experiences, how do you intend to go about publishing something that the entire collective doesn't necessarily agree on? Or what's that process like for you guys? Have you figured that out?
The process itself is still pretty ambiguous. We haven't really... Our first wave of publications is going to be coming about in the next couple of weeks. And I guess we're probably going to streamline things a lot more during that process. But as it stands, the idea is when something is going to become a potential publication, we submit it to the group as a whole, and then the group as a whole looks it over. And if your question is how would we resolve differences of opinion on things, I can only say that we would try and do it with as much of a consensus model as possible. Sit down, have everybody know what's being written and what's intended, and then to try and come to some sort of consensus-based resolution. But I think all of our politics are quite similar, or at least they're enough within a spectrum such that major disagreement is not likely. Mm-hmm. And with regards to the journalistic objectivity, sorry if I'm taking up too much time, but I just want to clarify.
No.
It's not necessarily that we believe that being right is impossible. It's that, at least for me, when I think of journalistic objectivity, I think of a virtue that tries to establish two or more sides to a scenario and then to try and arbitrate between them. But sometimes that's not the method that most closely encapsulates the truth. So I think when we say journalistic objectivity isn't real, we only mean to say that, or it isn't possible, we only mean to say that it's not possible to always get the truth through this neutral arbitrating method.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to build off of that, I think in the language of neutrality, it can often be said that could end up supporting the status quo. So, yeah. But also going back to the earlier point, I think because we do come from, like, these diverse experiences, I think that's really a strength for us as well, because we will be able to lean on each other for support, especially on issues that, like, for example, I may not be so versed on animal rights issues, but some members of our collective would, and, you know, so we can definitely build off of that for sure. And I guess it all relates back to our collective structure and how we really do want to really have established ourselves as, you know, every decision is made collectively, including the articles we publish.
You guys have recently been called pundits or leftist-leaning pundits. On that note, do you intend to be overtly and openly political with your publication?
Can I show this one? Yeah, I mean, I'd gladly identify as a left-leaning pundit. And I think that is in part the point. I don't take it as offense. The idea is to offer a certain vocabulary even on issues. It is to take a stance, quite frankly. It's not to be neutral. It's not to be somber. It's to be provocative, and it's to be opinionated. And who described us as left-leaning pundits?
He was Terry Talks.
Oh,
it was.
I see.
Yeah, there was an article posted.
Yeah. Yeah, and on that note, we're going to be unapologetic about our pieces and our opinions, I mean.
Well, that's exciting. There's something exciting about that for sure. Going back into a wider scale of talking about traditional forms of media, given that traditional forms of media on university campuses and otherwise have been struggling amidst dropping advertising revenues and budget cuts and staff cuts, how does an independent publication, the one that's brand new, such as The Talon, intend to stay afloat in an already struggling industry?
That's a good question. As we said earlier, a lot of the process of starting this new editorial collective is really, like, you know, grassroots, like, case by case, and just, like, learning along the way. But I guess, like, we have decided that we will only be an online resource or an online publication, and I guess that's kind of ties into, like, the declining rates of print media. And I guess, well, we do have a fundraiser party coming up, for example, and that's kind of one of the ways that we're raising funds right now, just to be able to keep up that momentum and build that sustainability, hopefully. And so, yeah, the launch party is on September 23rd at the Railway Club. Shameless promotion. 8 p.m.
I think in terms of staying afloat, so to speak, we have a couple things going for us. One is our independence. We're not a subsidiary of the university, and we're not a subsidiary of any other establishment. So we do not absolutely depend upon a larger decision-making apparatus or their ability to assist us financially. And as Aruba mentioned, our decision to be almost exclusively an online resource also cuts down on costs. I mean, thankfully, we don't have any gross overhead costs at the moment, but we do intend to keep it that way. I also think it's a good way to remaining accessible. If we don't go print, or we don't become pay to get
right
what you want to read,
right,
or whatever.
Yeah.
And one last question, maybe if I can address each of you individually. What impact do you personally hope that The Talon will have on the campus and community in your wildest dreams?
Well, that's a big one. But I guess one of the main goals that, not only for me, but the collective as well, is that we'll reach a varied readership. We don't want to just be, you know, preaching to the choir. We don't want to just be talking to other student organizers on campus and other activists on campus about the issues that we all kind of discuss anyway. We want to be able to reach out and share our perspectives and also gain the perspectives of those that may not necessarily, like, you know, deal with some of the issues that we're talking about. And yeah, I mean, I would love for The Talon to, you know, like 50 years down the line when I come back as an alumni and it's still here and it's still thriving and it's strong and there's, like, real, like, critical media on campus through The Talon. I mean, that would be amazing.
Very ambitious. How about you, Jordan?
Yeah, I think to echo Aruba's sentiment, one of our short-term goals is definitely to stay alive. In terms of the long term, I think it would be great if we could resuscitate the idea of on-campus activist journalism. In fact, if we were to influence others into starting their own publications, whether they were right of center, left of center, whatever, that would be great. I would love that. Just more ongoing and dedicated student activism in the form of publications like these would be wonderful. And if we could have that influence, I'd be more than happy.
Well, all the best to you guys. Thank you so much for that. That was Aruba Jamal and Jordan Buffy with the Talon of UBC, launching later this month.
A show dedicated to playing psychedelic music from parts of the spectrum, rock, pop, electronic, as well as garage and noise rock. Sundays, 5 to 6 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM.
The Westside Community Food Market is back every Thursday at 3 p.m. to 7 p.m. from July 3rd to September 25th. A stretch of sidewalk at 8th and Vine will be turned into a local food market. Join us for hyper-local foods, live music, coffee, and more.
In Indigenous cultures across the globe, women are givers and creators of sacred life. They nurture and shape our children. They influence future generations through the early interactions and teachings they pass on to our youth. These transfers of knowledge are in grave danger as women are common victims of violence, especially in communities where extractive industries are taking place. Violence against Indigenous women and children is one of the most serious violations of human rights, and Indigenous people have to work as equal partners with states to develop standards and mechanisms to enforce women's rights, strengthen their civic and political participation, and protect them from the different forms of violence they are commonly subjected to. We need to bring the issue of violence against women to light and work to uncover the extent of this problem so that we can seek the needed resources to put an end to this grave injustice towards Indigenous women. This series shares the concepts and recommendations contained in the ALTA outcome document. For more information, visit WCIP2014.org.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thanks for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Good evening, people. This is Marco from UBC's AstroTalk. In our lead story, everybody missed it, I think, and it almost got us, but it missed us. Yes, a house-sized asteroid just missed Earth last week. The 60-foot asteroid passed between the Earth and the Moon and came very close to some Earth satellites. The asteroid was called 2014 RC, and it came within 25,000 miles of Earth. Another asteroid in February 2013 came within 17,200 miles of Earth. This was an unexpected asteroid, which shows how Earth is still in the firing line from asteroids and comets. There are 11,000 near-Earth objects that have been discovered, and these are asteroids or comets. This last asteroid could be seen over Australia and New Zealand. In other space news, India's gone into space. India's maiden Mars voyage is 2 weeks from Mars. On September 24th, the Mars Orbiter mission, or cutely known as MOM, will fire its engines and begin to orbit Mars. This is very important, and it is very different from when the USA went to the moon. The moon is very close, so the US rockets from NASA don't have to fire their engines very much because we do not build up very high speeds. But this is something scientists have to take into account. When a space mission, manned mission, is sent to Mars, then this rocket will go much faster. So there is a lot more fuel required to slow the rocket down when it enters Mars orbit. The radio signals from Mars take about 20 minutes to reach here. And the Indian probe, which is 11 months into its journey, weighs 2,890 pounds. Again, the burn will take place on September 24th and will bring the capsule into the Mars orbit. In medical news, scientists have uncovered a navigation system used by nerve cells. Duke University has discovered a roving detection system on the surface of cells that may point to a new way of treating cancers. These new cells are able to break through normal tissue boundaries and burrow into other tissues and organs. This will be a crucial step in the development process of finding a cure for cancer. Usually, cells do this in processes such as embryonic development, wound healing, and the formation of new blood cells. But sometimes the process goes awry and leads to cancer, and these cancer cells can therefore spread unchecked. David Sherwood, professor of Duke University, is investigating the molecular mechanisms that control cell evasion and in normal blood development and cancer. He is using a 1 millimeter worm known as C. elegans, or another name is nitrin. The nitrin can institute cell invasion to kill the cancer cell. In local environmental news, local that is, in Canada, the Canadian press has reported that there is so much disturbance from decades of industrial use in the Alberta oil lands. Biologist Laura Finnegan is into the first year of a three-year study. She is from the Foothills Research Institute from Hilton, Alberta. Professor Finnegan says, and quote, "There's just so much disturbance, so it's important to prioritize if we want restoration of the caribou habitat. Recent satellite data has shown that the foothills is being deforested at a rate that is much higher than the deforestation that is taking place in Brazil's rainforest. The energy industry in this small area of study has cut 16,000 kilometers of seismic line cuts. These are lines that geologists cut to study the underground to see if there's oil. There's also been a lot of clear cut and a lot of access roads. Snowmobiles also rampage through the territory, disrupting the caribou's habitat. The federal government has set a target of 65% restoration, but now only 5% of the range for the smoke for the Little Smoky and Lapeet caribou herds remain undisturbed. Because of the seismic line cuts, wolves can now penetrate deep into the forest to hunt caribou. Wolves usually only hunt deer and moose, and so now the caribou habitat is being disrupted and ravaged, but this is not the only place. This study area is only one small area all the way down to Alberta's western edge. In other environmental news, from the Globe and Mail, one of their columnists, Peter Cheney, took a test ride. He went from San Diego to Whistler in a new 140,000 Tesla Model S car. The car is built by the SpaceX company. This company builds rockets, and now it has constructed 140 electrical recharging stations in the U.S. The journey was a 2,800-kilometer journey, and Peter Cheney tells of the remarkable journey he made with this electric car. The car has no sound, just the high speed of air floating over the car. And it has no sound and no gas pollution or noise pollution like a normal combustion engine does. Before this model, Tesla Model S, other electric cars were like glorified golf carts. But the Model S is a new breed of car. Its throttle response is instant. It has no gears, no valves, no spark plugs, so it doesn't need any oil changes, doesn't need any gasoline, pollutes nothing, so it is a worthy replacement for the internal combustion engine. The filling stations pump electricity instead of gas, and SpaceX has, as I mentioned, has built 140 of these stations throughout the U.S. The energy that powers these filling stations comes from the sun, so they are totally solar-powered. Peter Cheney, the driver, said, and quote, the car handles great through curves, it has instant power and accurate steering, The only potential problem is, where is the next charging station? But if someone buys a car from SpaceX, the fuel will be free for life. You can fill up for free at any one of their supercharger stations around North America. The motor is like an oversized coffee can, and Cheney says this car is vastly superior to the internal combustion engine car. But Mr. Cheney says we need more supercharging stations. Stay tuned. There might be more news from the Model S Tesla. This is Marco. You are up to date in science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. Up next, we have a live interview with Nadia Roberts, one of the volunteer organizers of the upcoming Rally for Arbitration being held this Sunday at the Vancouver Art Gallery.
Nadia, do we have you on the IR?
Yep, I'm here.
Perfect. So can you tell us a little bit about what's going on Sunday?
Yes, so there's a few of us, a group of parents, who've organized a rally on Sunday at 10 a.m. at the Art Gallery downtown in Vancouver. On the north side of the Art Gallery, and it is a rally for parents, by parents, but really it's for anyone in the province concerned about the status of public health in BC. And we're making it very clear that it's by parents, because the last rally that we had, the BCTF organized the big rally downtown, and I know like hundreds of parents who went there, but in the news it was reported that it was mostly teachers there. So I think this time we're being very clear that so that people know it is a small group of parents organizing. We have no support, zero funding, and really it's for people who want arbitration to end the strike so our kids can get back to school.
And so what exactly is the goal of this rally?
The goal is to put pressure on the government and let the government know that there are a lot of people out there, a lot of parents out there who want them to agree to arbitration.
And why do you personally feel that arbitration would lead to the most satisfying outcome?
Well, I think at this point there's three options. We could have arbitration, we could have negotiation, or they could legislate them back to work. And Fassbender has been really clear that they are not willing to legislate back to work. That's not on the table. Although it sounds in the past few days like it might be on the table, and there might be a little opening for that. But until that now, he's been very clear that that wasn't an option, and I don't think that's necessarily a good option. The other option is negotiation, which does not seem to be happening. It hasn't worked. Although, again, now they're saying Vince Reddy might come back in and sit down with them, so maybe mediation is possible. But, again, that's just the past couple of days that's been an option. Until now, it has not been.
Now, do you
Sorry, and so arbitration is the third option, and I think parents are just feeling like the BCTF has stepped forward last week. The huge majority, over 90% of their members, have said that they agree to go back to work now if the government agrees to arbitration. And so I think they're willing to risk losing a lot of what they're asking for, but the government's not willing to step up and accept arbitration. I think a lot of parents are frustrated, and we want our kids in school. They've already missed 4 weeks, and that's too much. It's too much for kids, especially high school kids, but any kids.
Now, looking at arbitration, like Minister Fassbender has already said that he's not interested in going to a third party, and Finance Minister Mike DeJong has also said that that's not something that the government is willing to do. Mm-hmm. But do you think that the government's small opening, again, to looking at negotiation. Do you think that's coming from the threat of a push for arbitration?
Oh, I'm sure. I think at this point they're realizing something has to happen. The BCTF has pretty much put the cards back in the government's hand and said, we've done all we can do. We're willing to go to arbitration. I mean, you can't expect them to do much more. They're saying they're willing to accept whatever an arbitrator decides. They're willing to give up much of what they've asked for. So I think in the public's eye, it's clear the government now looks like the ones who are holding this up. And they are. So I think people want to see something happen. The government knows that. They also know this can't go on much longer without. I mean, it is really disrupting people's students' lives. It's getting to the point now where the constitutional right of education has been threatened. And a lot of parents who are putting together class action civil lawsuits against the government, saying that they are, they've lost out on a lot of things. Money, time. The constitutional right of school has been put in threat, and people are wanting to make action. So I think the government's feeling threatened and nervous at this point. They need to do something, and they know that.
Now, looking at this from the BCTF perspective, if they are willing to go to arbitration and, potentially lose any benefits that they're seeking, what do you think the difference is between them just then saying, okay, yes, we'll go back to work, and you know, whatever the government wants to do, let them do that, and we'll get back to negotiation at some point. What's the real difference, do you think?
Oh, I think the difference is if an arbitrator came in, they would at least, their demands, I mean, an arbitrator's job is to meet halfway. So it would, they know, they trust, and they would, I'm sure, would help select the arbitrator, and it would be someone they helped that everyone agreed on. So they know that their demands would at least be partially met, which is, you know, that they're taking a big risk in losing some things, but they also know that that person would take them seriously. If they went back to work now and nothing happened, then they're back to where they were months ago, and they're back at the whim of the government, and I think they have no leg to stand on. They'd have nothing. Right now, they have a lot of support behind them, a lot of parents. Every parent I know is supporting the BCTF at this point. Yeah. I know that not all parents in the province are,
and I was just going to say,
most parents I know are.
So. Well, in terms of that, because on Sunday the 7th, there was a rally of parents out at the Bank of Argyle, which was against BCTF.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Do you know what the attendance was at that?
I don't have the numbers, but from the film footage, it looked like it was, you know, it was a decent number of people. It wasn't, you know, a handful. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think there are. I think the media, first of all, has been very good at promoting the party line, the government's line. I think the media, until recently, we haven't heard much. On Global the other day, there was a great interview, I don't know if you heard that, with the former justice. I don't know her name, sorry. It was a 10-minute interview that was really got down to the basics and took a line, and she was talking about the E80 clause and sort of being very critical of the government. And that's the first time I've seen in the media and mainstream media anything that really made people pause to think, well, maybe we shouldn't be listening to everything the government's saying. Maybe they are actually scared. Maybe they, you know, but the past 12 years, they've been cutting back on education more and more. And Christy Clark started in 2002 by taking out class size and composition, and they're accountable for that. They've been found guilty twice of bargaining in bad faith, so they need to do something to address that, and I don't think they want to. And I think they're working really hard to make sure other people think that they're in the right for that. So I think a lot of parents out there, not a lot of them, the parents who did go to that rally are buying into everything in the media. I mean, if you just listen to the media, it's easy to think, yeah, teachers are greedy, they should stop striking, they want so much. But the more you dig and the more research, it's so obvious.
And now, we are out of time, but if people do want to get involved with this, what is the best way for them to do so?
Come to the rally on Sunday at 10 a.m. or go to the Facebook page. I'm sure you can look it up. I don't have to.
We'll link it to our website.
Yes, they should go to the Facebook page and tell us they want to get involved and help.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much for your time, Nadia.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, take care. And that was Nadia Roberts. We're going to take a quick PSA break, and we'll be right back with more News 101.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Attention grad students. Share your research, find out what's going on in other disciplines, approach your work from a new angle. Check out Fire Talks, the interdisciplinary discussion forum sponsored by the Research Commons at Kerner Library. Visit bit.ly/firetalk for more information.
Has mental illness or addiction touched your life? You might be interested in coming out to the Kaleidoscope, UBC's first and only student-created, peer-run mental health support group at the university's Vancouver campus. They offer a stigma-free place for people to share their stories with others going through similar experiences. The Kaleidoscope meets every week on Tuesdays from 5 to 6 p.m. at the Center for Student Involvement in Brock Hall.
Learn more at the-kaleidoscope.com.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
For our next segment on the show, we have a report by news correspondent Valerio DeFio, bringing us recent updates on climate change.
Good morning. Today I want to talk about climate change and according to the Free Wilderness Committee newspaper, I want to report this. The Salish Sea, the body of water comprising of the Strait of Georgia, Puget Sound, and the Juan de Fuca Strait, is a precious resource that has sustained life in the Pacific Northwest region for thousands of years. From the millions of salmon that migrate through its waters, to the temperate rainforests lining its shores, to the power and grace of its resident killer whales, this remarkable stretch of ocean provides endless gifts. Several fossil fuel export projects proposed in the Salish Sea pose serious threats. If we work together, the Salish Sea will become the place where we stood up and took responsibility for climate change. So this is a report from Save the Salish Sea, from a free report of published by the Wilderness Committee, which is the Canadian environmental organization that works for climate change. And there are four problems, like fossil fuel export affect the Salish Sea. Kinder Morgan's pipeline and tanker proposal, like the fact is we're not prepared for a major spill event, they report, and just one large spill would have devastating environmental and economic consequences. Owen Maiden, climate campaigner, report. And regarding Metro Vancouver is the province's largest port. Port Metro Vancouver has been quietly working to increase its export capacity and become the largest coal exporter in North America. So the next week, Wilderness Committee, 350 organization of Seattle and Georgia Strait Alliance, they organize a climate change called Climate Change Knows No Borders International Rally. So they organize a rally. They will meet at Peace Arch Border Saturday, September 20th from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m. They will call for cross-border action by citizens and politicians to defend the Salish Sea from a juggernaut of new coal, oil, and liquid natural gas export projects.
Thank you very much. Up next on the program, we have an interview with Ashley Bentley, the acting manager of the AMS Sexual Assault Support Center.
Ashley, welcome to News 101.
Hi, happy to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit about what SASC is?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you for having us on the show. So the AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre is a service for survivors of sexualized violence or harassment or discrimination. Our centre is open to all UBC students, but also to staff and faculty, or even friends and family members of survivor. So we do support the entire community. We're a centre for all genders as well. We're very inclusive of various populations. So we try and create a really safe space for everybody to access our services.
And who actually works here at SASC?
So we have two full-time permanent staff. So we have a management position and the assistant manager position. Currently, I'm in the acting manager role. And we also have a student position, which is 12 hours a week for the academic year, and that's an outreach worker position. And this year we have our outreach worker Marina, who's awesome. And we also have a team of about 20 volunteers, and we're actually doing our training this weekend.
What level of training are you providing your volunteers?
So our volunteers are mostly outreach volunteers and office volunteers. So they don't actually do any support work. So it's more things like doing boothing, facilitating workshops, doing awareness campaigns, and contributing to our blog piece, or also helping with office tasks as well. So our volunteers are more kind of key players in essentially raising awareness of our services on campus and trying to educate people around consent and sexual assault and various other topics.
So in terms of counselling, who provides the counselling services?
So at the Sexual Assault Support Centre, we don't actually provide direct counselling. What we provide is short-term emotional crisis support. So anybody can come here Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, and they can just drop in, or they can call or make an appointment, and then we'll see them right away. And then we kind of work with people for up to 6 sessions just to see what it is that they're needing. If they do feel that they need more long-term counselling, if they're experiencing severe trauma or anxiety or depression, we usually connect them to UBC Counselling Services. And predominantly Jennifer Hollinshead, who is the sexual assault counsellor there. And Jennifer does also come to our office sometimes, and we liaise with her quite a lot. So if a client feels more comfortable seeing her in the SASC space, that's okay too.
I had heard that you also run workshops for some of the frats.
Yeah, absolutely. So our standardized training is the Anti-Violence Ally training, which is a 2.5-hour training that we offer every month. It looks at definitions and legalities around sexual assault and consent, but also shows people how to support a survivor. You know, we don't expect people to learn how to be counselors, but just kind of like immediate support, some things to say, some things not to say, and also just, you know, some resources that they can also refer people to. So we have that training once a month, but a lot of different groups on campus, including fraternities, can have like a personalized session for a time that suits them.
In terms of demographic, who most often is accessing your services here?
So predominantly in terms of our emotional support services, it is women that access our service. And when it comes to sexual assault, it is more of a gendered crime in nature. However, we really do try to promote that, you know, anybody can be a survivor and anybody can be a perpetrator, which is why our centre is for all genders. And I do feel as well that there's a lot of stigma around, you know, men experiencing sexual assault, and a lot of centres as well can be quite transphobic. So for us, like, we really try and encourage, you know, folks from the LGBT community to access our services, because this is a safe space for them and it's also a safe space for men.
And looking at your volunteer base, is that range of diversity reflected, or do you still have primarily women volunteering?
Well, this year actually was, I think we've had the most volunteer applications that we've ever had, which was kind of amazing. I feel like it's probably related to the current discussions on campus and some of the things that happened last year. And I think sexual assault and rape culture is really on people's minds, which is great, because we need to keep having these conversations if we're going to see any change. And yeah, I think that was reflected in our applications. We've definitely had a lot more applications from men and, you know, folks who are maybe gender variant.
And do you look at cultural variance in emotional support needs and in definitions of sexual violence?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when we're looking at different intersectionalities of oppression, that's really like the standpoint that, you know, we operate from, and it's really closely linked to our mandate. So we do really try to be aware of different cultural differences when people come through the door, because, you know, even in westernized cultures, it's hard to talk about sexual assault, but in some other cultures, people don't even necessarily know the right language to use, or that it's even a crime. And obviously different, you know, countries have different laws around sexual assault as well. So being really mindful of that is also really important. If we ever needed to bring in an interpreter for whatever reason, we can always do that for clients as well.
How do you maintain confidentiality when you're working with volunteers who are students and they may be working with their peers? How do you guys deal with that?
When we do the training, we do get all of our volunteers to sign a confidentiality agreement. And we do go over that in the training as well, that, you know, sometimes they might be in the office and someone might come in for support and they may know that person, right? Like, even though this is a campus of over like 40,000 people, the likelihood is that you might know someone walking through the door. So we do like, as I say, the confidentiality form, and also explaining training that if this does happen, that, you know, what happens at the SASC stays at the SASC. And also just with the volunteer group as well, you know, they spend 2.5 days together training, and I'm sure some of them probably have their own stories as well. And so also maintaining that, you know, what's shared within that group stays there.
And I guess the last thing, if people do want to get involved or want to access any of your training or services, what would be the best
way for them to do that?
We've had a few technical difficulties the past few days with our website, but it's back up and running as of about half an hour ago. So you can access our website, which is gotconsent.ca, and you can see all about our different training opportunities and other ways that you can get involved. And also, I would definitely encourage you to like our Facebook, which is the AMS Sexual Assault Support Centre, so you can keep up to date with events that we're hosting, but also other community events that might be of interest to you within like a social justice kind of spectrum.
Thank you very much, Ashley.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Ashley, welcome to News 101.
That's our program for today, September 12th. Today's newscast